So now it is my distinct pleasure to give the Advocate Award to Allison Singer. So as most of you know, Allison is the co-founder and president of the Autism Science Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to funding innovative autism research and supporting the needs of people with autism. She is also the mother of a 19-year-old daughter with autism and the legal guardian of her older brother with autism. Allison has served in the community in many, many roles. I'm just going to name a few of them. It's quite remarkable when I looked at her bio, just the number of ways that she is touching the community. So I will list some of them here. She serves on the Federal Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. This is the committee that develops the strategic plan for autism research for the United States, as well as other federal committees, for example, on the CDC. She's on the boards of the Yale Child Study Center, the Seaver Autism Center, the Marcus Autism Center, and the University of North Carolina Autism Research Center. And now, gosh, I've got to have you come to Duke, my gosh. And the Simons Foundation Spark Advisory Board. In 2012, the American Academy of Pediatrics named her an autism champion. Allison also chairs the INSAR Communications Committee, and I can say from firsthand knowledge that this is just a tremendous amount of work. She has a very significant impact on our ability as an organization to communicate our message out to the community. And she also serves on the INFAR Program Committee. So in all of these areas, she's been effective in turning her passion for improving the lives of people with autism into action that has made a real difference. So I can think of no one more deserving of the Advocate Award than Allison Singer.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you to INSAR. I am incredibly honored to receive this award. Supporting autism research is a huge part of my life, and I am truly grateful to receive an award that honors stakeholder commitment to research. Ironically, though, if you had asked me back when I was in college, if you had told me back when I was in college that one day I would receive an award for supporting autism research, I think I would have thought you were crazy. I was probably the only person I knew in college who knew exactly what she wanted to do. I wanted to be a television journalist, and that's what I became. But life has a way of disrupting our plans, and in my case, that happened in 1999 when my then 2-year-old daughter, Jody, was diagnosed with autism. I was no stranger to autism when Jody was diagnosed. Back in 1968, my older brother, Stephen, was diagnosed with autism when he was 4 and I was 2. Back then, in the 1960s, there was no such thing as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, no law enabling him to go to school, no services or treatments of any kind. My mother was told that his autism was her fault and that it had happened because her first thought when she woke up after giving birth was that my newborn brother resembled a scrawny chicken. Apparently, she was told, that single thought was enough to make him retreat into autism. She was called a refrigerator mother, and she was told that the best thing she could do for him was to send him away. But instead, my mother searched for some sort of scientific study about autism that he could enroll in, although they were practically non-existent. Finally, she found a study of children with autism at Bellevue Hospital with Dr. Magda Campbell. One of the requirements for getting my brother into the study was that my mother had to undergo Freudian psychoanalysis. After all, autism was her fault. And since scientists wanted to learn about the cause of autism, they studied the mothers. My mother accepted this humiliation so that Stephen could be enrolled in the study for 2 years, during which time he lived as an inpatient at Bellevue. And then the study ended. I'm told that Bellevue pulled a lot of strings to get my brother placed into the residential facility closest to where we lived at the time, and that was Willowbrook. Willowbrook, which of course has become the symbol of the horror of 1970s mental institutions. Every Saturday, we would visit Stephen there. Visiting Stephen mostly meant my sitting alone or with the other siblings in the visitor's room, watching the static-ridden black-and-white television mounted on the corner of the ceiling, which was always permanently tuned to Channel 9 in New York, which showed either New York Mets games or reruns of Abbott and Costello. What I most remember is listening to moaning and screaming and how the hospital always smelled like ammonia. After a few months, I begged my mother to let me take tap dancing lessons with my friend Cheryl so that I wouldn't have to go there anymore. And finally, she relented. I had no idea that she was already hard at work trying to get my brother out of there. A few months later, we moved out of New York City so that my brother could transfer to a residential center in Rockland County. And I tried to push autism out of my mind. Until my daughter was born. Jody had problems from birth. She didn't sleep. She rarely ate. She spent most of her time crying. She showed no interest in the playground or toys that other children liked. She was diagnosed with failure to thrive, early colic, late colic, extreme colic, and quote, "I've never seen colic like this." As she got older, she played with toys in very strange ways, lining them up or sorting them by size and color. I would use a spoon and pretend to feed her teddy bear, and she would become obsessed with the tag on the bear that indicated the contents of the stuffing. I asked my mom if Stephen had ever done these things and was incredibly relieved when she said no. So I tried to stop worrying. I ignored plenty of red flags. Motor delays, very limited smiling, no showing, no babbling, no pointing, no waving bye-bye. When I called her name, she never responded. But I knew she could hear, because if I turned on the television and she heard Elmo, she would come running. When Jody's teacher told me that Jody had to leave her preschool and that we should call early intervention, I was heartbroken and distraught. When eventually she was diagnosed with autism by several leading specialists, including our keynoter on Saturday, Dr. Ami Klin, I accepted it, but I was devastated. My mother and I were nearly hysterical as horrific memories of Willowbrook flooded our minds. But fortunately, things had improved significantly since the 1960s. Every state is now required to provide early intervention services, and Jody had 40 hours a week of evidence-based therapy for several years. Like many other autism moms, I quit my job, bought materials, put them in clear, not colored, clear boxes, labeled, relabeled, monitored progress, organized toys, and saved her favorite activities, like visiting the petting zoo or playing with the puppies at the ASPCA, as rewards to be earned through her token economy. I took and tallied data, fought regularly with the insurance company, and attended meeting after meeting after meeting. After 3 years of intensive work in therapy, we took her for retesting. I could see that she had made progress, and I was sure that despite her lack of language, I would be told that she was ready for mainstream kindergarten. But in fact, she had made very minimal progress. Jody is extremely challenged by her autism. From kindergarten to ninth grade, she was in 6 different schools. She has made progress. She's gained some language, and I know she understands more than she says. The only other child she had ever shown interest in was her sister. She rarely slept more than 3 or 4 hours a night. She is very prone to wandering and needs constant supervision. Worst of all, she tends to be self-injurious. There is nothing on earth harder than watching your child peel the skin off her arm or bang her head on the ground. But the stories get better. Stephen turned 53 this year and is now living in a group home in Suffern, New York, with 5 other men with autism. They deliver Meals on Wheels 4 mornings a week, and we continue to try new interventions to teach him to talk because it is never too late. Jody, now 19, recently moved to a residential placement at the Center for Discovery in upstate New York, which is a farming-based school. There, she is doing what she loves, taking care of animals. Being with animals is no longer her reward for work well done. It is her work well done. She gets up early to feed the baby goats bottles of milk. She collects eggs, feeds the chickens, flops the pigs, every mom's dream. She measures their food and water, and she sits for hours providing love and comfort to animals who are sick. She has turned her lifelong love of animals into a true vocation. And just like when I was a child, we go to visit her every Saturday, but that's where the similarities stop. She is in an amazing community with well-trained, loving staff, and her house smells like nail polish, not ammonia. She lives with 4 other young women with autism, and she has made her first friend. At 19 years old, she finally found a friend. Jody and her friend Jamie don't talk, but they seek each other out, and they sit on their beds and play together on their iPads or watch television. And sometimes they will silently brush each other's hair. And they don't have to watch Abbott and Costello or even the New York Mets because they have cable TV and a Wii Fit. Likewise, my brother is in the best situation of his life with caring support staff, meaningful work, and same-age disabled peers with whom he comfortably interacts and who share his interest in jigsaw puzzles. And yet, both Jody's and Stephen's futures are again under threat, this time because of misguided regulations from Medicaid, the public insurance program in the United States that covers most residential care for people with disabilities. These new regulations threaten to shut down intentional communities and disability-specific housing settings, like the ones Jody and Stephen live in, because some believe they are not integrated enough into the mainstream community. Thousands of people could literally be ripped from residences they love, where they are happy and thriving, and others will not be able to choose these types of living arrangements, even though it may be what they want and what is best for them. We all bristle at the word institution, I especially, having witnessed Willowbrook firsthand. But today's residential settings are nothing like the institutions of the 70s, and disability-specific housing is a critically important option. In fact, it may be the only option that meets the intensive 24/7 needs of people with constant seizures, intellectual disability, elopement issues, and self-injurious behaviors. Individuals with severe disabilities have a civil right to choose how and where they want to live, just as we all do. Some may not be able to choose using language because they don't have language. And so we have to look for nonverbal signals of what they want. In my daughter's case, for example, I can see it in how happy she looks, in the fact that she's always eager to get back to her house and her job, the fact that she has made friends there with other girls who share her narrow interests, the fact that everyone who visits her remarks on how happy she looks, and the fact that because of all this, she's able to take less anxiety medication. So please help us fight for choice and for as many housing options as possible to meet the wide variety of needs we have in our community. No types of housing should be off the table. Perhaps one of the reasons the Medicaid regulations have become so convoluted is because the word autism has as well. Autism used to mean something specific. Until recently, it described a consistent cluster of symptoms. But today, the word autism has become such a big tent term that the people under that tent often have very little in common with each other. Autism can mean genius IQ or IQ below 50. Autism can mean highly verbal or nonverbal. It can mean graduating from Harvard Law School or exiting high school with a certificate of attendance. It can mean self-injury, sleep disorders, aggression, pica, wandering, biting, or not. Thanks to decades of research by many people at this meeting, we know that autism encompasses core symptoms that are present in each person who was diagnosed. But the abilities and needs of those people are vastly different. If we are going to be able to personalize our approach to care and provide benefits to all people, we need terminology and language that are specific and meaningful. In fact, the DSM-5 was supposed to do this. It was supposed to provide greater specificity so that a diagnosis would point towards potential services. But because of the way DSM-5 is applied, the opposite has happened. Everyone is lumped together as having ASD. To the broader public, the word autism only describes the more traditionally skilled, visible end of the spectrum, because those individuals are able to have a voice, are able to represent themselves at meetings, and are the ones who appear in the media. Autistic people with the most challenging behaviors have become invisible and are being left behind. Many of them cannot speak for themselves, and so this task falls to their parents. In fact, the basic civil rights of some people with autism are not being protected because the abilities and disabilities at each end of the spectrum diverge, putting parents and caregivers at odds with those who have the ability to advocate for themselves. This problem of language and nomenclature is a disservice to both ends of the spectrum and to those in the middle. It makes research much more challenging, and several self-advocates with whom I've discussed this have recounted how hard it was for them to access services because they didn't fit the mold of severe autism. The reality is that the current use of the broad term autism may unintentionally be depriving many people of the services, attention, help, and supports that they need because of this lack of specificity. Research has revealed how heterogeneous autism is. To use a single word to describe it is a disservice to the knowledge we have gained and to the people we love. We need new terminology. I urge everyone here today to consider abandoning the use of the word autism to describe the most severely disabled in favor of a new term, any term, as long as that word has some precision and points toward a compendium of interventions and supports that are needed by people with severe, debilitating disability. Or maybe the answer is to bring back the Asperger's diagnosis. The term Asperger's had meaning and provided insights into the type of interventions that were likely required. In any event, I hope that many of you will join me in starting this necessary and important conversation in our community. In closing, I want to thank the visionary and strong stakeholder advocates who came before me and upon whose shoulders I proudly stand. Of course, there are many dozens, but I want to mention Karen and Eric London, Debbie Hillebrand, and John Shestack and Portia Iverson, who founded the first parent research advocacy groups, NAR and CAN. Without their commitment to research, children and adults today would not have the options that they do. All of these years of research have mattered. The pace of research may feel slow to parents. We want answers yesterday. But because of their work, children today get earlier and more precise diagnosis, more effective treatment, and have more evidence-based treatment options. I also want to single out Dr. Tom Insel, from whom I learned a tremendous amount just by watching how he handled very challenging situations. And of course, Suzanne Wright. Suzanne was a huge mentor to me, and I miss her every day. Suzanne cared deeply about every child, every person, and every family. She taught us all never to take no for an answer and always to think bigger. I'm also so grateful to all of you in this room who dedicate your careers to improving the lives of our families. And I'm particularly grateful to those of you who serve on the Autism Science Foundation Scientific Advisory Board, because you enable us to find and fund the important science that will change lives. And finally, thank you to INSAR. I am incredibly humbled and honored to receive this award. Thank you.